Maybe that's not far from the truth. My name is Jim Shields, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be here tonight. I actually live in Laguna Hills, but Irvine's close. I work in Irvine. It seems like I live there sometimes. Well, when I actually do work. But it's good to be here tonight. I want to thank Valerie for asking me to come and speak and share my experience, strength, and hope. And maybe I will. And I'm old, because I can't remember everything. I can't see either, so I don't know why the hell I'm like that. Yeah, that's it. That's what happens, you know, when I never expected to live past 30. It was just not in my plan. You know, I had to take a better care of myself if I was going to live this long. I was like, oh, shit. You know, I didn't know. Nobody told me, you know. I figured, you know, I'm dead long before I'm 30, so, you know, why do I have to be here? And, you know, it's amazing to see how many people came out to hear Nayeli speak, because everybody likes her, you know. I'm not that popular, but it's good to be here tonight. She did a great job, and, you know, she is a shining example of the program. You know, people who come in and will actually do some work and their life changes, and that's the amazing thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there are four things that qualify me to be up here and speak tonight, and the first one is I have a sobriety date, and my sobriety date is January 31st of 1986, and that was not that I'm counting, but that was 8,120 days ago. And you know what? I worked for every last one of them. You know? I remember a few years ago, I was taking a cake at a meeting I go to called the Soup Kitchen, and they actually put a candle on for each year, and each person takes the cake separately. And I had like 18 years, and they were trying to pawn me off with 16 candles. And I said, no. Those 2 years almost killed me. You know? I earned those. I earned those. The other thing I have is a home group. And I have two home groups, actually. I have the Do It Sober meeting, which meets at 7:30 every day over on Moulton Avenue, 7:30 every morning. And I'm there almost every morning, unless I'm not. But usually I'm there. And, you know, I go there not necessarily because I need a meeting. I go there because I want to be available. And that's what my sponsor tells me. That's why he goes to so many meetings. And he's somebody that needs to go to a lot of meetings. But, I have another home group, a new home group, and it's a book study on Thursday nights in Aliso Viejo. And, you know, we sit down and we actually study the book, word for word, line for line. And because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. It's all about the book, and it's all about doing the steps. And it's all about doing them. It's not about thinking about the steps, analyzing the steps, talking about the steps, thinking about the steps. It's actually doing them. Actually sitting down with a pen and paper and doing an inventory, and actually sitting down, you know, with a sponsor and doing a fifth step and you know, all that stuff. And the other thing I have is I have a sponsor. My sponsor is Jim Stevens. He's going senile, and he needs to go to a lot of meetings. And I, you know, I wasn't important enough for him to be here tonight. But he sent Courtney in his place. You know, he has his own representative here tonight. So, you know, I guess that's okay. And, you know, the other thing, my sponsor has a sponsor, and my sponsor's sponsor is Ralph. If you're around here, you know Ralph. Ralph is a constant in the world around here, and Ralph has a sponsor, and his sponsor is Alice. And so I know where the chain goes up. And then you know, I'm lucky enough to have, you know, a few people that I sponsor. And you know, believe me, if you're not sponsoring some people, you're really missing out. I learn more from the people I sponsor than I could ever learn from my sponsor. Not because he's senile, because I just learned a lot from him. But, okay, nobody's allowed to rat me out on that. You know, what is said here stays here, blah, 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 you know. So, you know, don't rat me out. You know, I tell him he's senile all the time. You know, he was, not long ago, Mary and I were sitting in a meeting, and somebody shared about something, and we saw Jim raise his hand, and Mary looks at me and he says, oh, he's going to tell the story about blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, of course he is. And he starts talking, and then, you know, he tells, because that story, what is that, number 42, I think, is that what? He tells the same, you know, and people try to stop him, and I don't stop him, you know, because I always like to listen to see if he actually changes the stories. He usually doesn't. Unless he does, but you know, and the other thing I have is that I worked all 12 steps. You know, I worked all 12 steps. You know, recovery is all about the steps we take. It's not about the meetings we make. You know, you don't get sober by going to meetings. You know, and if you believe that lie, then you're on a wolf ticket because it's not true. You know, you can go to meetings and they'll keep you sober for a while. And they will keep you abstinent. They will not help you to recover from alcoholism. And, you know, because I worked those 12 steps, you know, I've had a spiritual experience. And the obsession to use and drink has been relieved from me. And, you know, that's a miracle. You know, I never thought I could stop. I never thought I could stop. It never occurred to me too much to really stop. I didn't realize that alcohol and drugs were my problem. You know, because it was everything else. You know, alcohol and drugs were my friend. And, you know, you can't talk bad about my friend because it saved me. You know, I believe alcohol and drugs were good for me. They really were. When I was a teenager, had I not had alcohol and drugs, I would have gone crazy. I'd have killed somebody or I'd have killed myself. And, you know, so they absolutely saved my life and they worked really well for me right up until the time that they didn't. And, you know, because I worked all 12 steps and because I've had that spiritual experience and the obsession has been relieved, you know, I am recovered. I am a recovered alcoholic. I'm not recovering. I'm not trying to recover. I am a recovered alcoholic. And I say that because that's not what you hear in meetings, but that is what you will see in the book if you actually read the book. I'm going to share something. Now, this is another thing you can't tell anybody else because it's a big secret. Mm-hmm. There's this yellow and blue book sitting back there on the shelf. It is the best-kept secret in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are so very few people that know anything about it. But, you know, it's actually the reason we're here. And, you know, in the foreword to the first edition, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And that's what it's all about. You know, it's not all about, you know, the social things are great, and those are things that help make sobriety fun, but it's all about how did I recover from this? How did I get better? You know, because I never planned on getting sober. I never planned on living past 30. So, you know, I'm surprised to be here. You know, I want to welcome all of the newcomers. You know, if you got here, you know, like the rest of us got here, and you did a bunch of stupid, crazy, wild things, then, you know, you're one of two things. You're either really stupid or you're an alcoholic. Now, if you're really stupid, I got nothing for you. You're on your own. I got nothing for you. You know, you can't. You know, Fred and I have talked about it a lot. You cannot cure stupid. We have tried. You cannot cure stupid. But if you're an alcoholic, we got some good news for you. You know, we actually have a way that you can get out of being who you are now, because you know, I didn't wake up one morning and say, you know, my life is going pretty good. I got money in the bank. I got money in my pocket. You know, people love me, and I've got no grief going on. You know, I think I'm going to go down and check out A&A and see what's happening with those guys. And you know, let me teach them how they can live a better life. You know, I got here because I was just done. I was at the end of my rope, and I don't talk a lot about, you know, my drinking and using. I don't know how anybody else got here tonight. I got here because I drank and I used a lot, and I did it as much as I could, as often as I could, and then I did it some more. And that was my story. And you know, Fortunately, somehow I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you about that. And you know, it's an amazing thing. You know, I really believe there's this old Buddhist saying that says, you know, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And that's come true for me so many times in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember being about 10 or 12 years sober, and I was flying back from the East Coast, and I had to fly through Dallas, which is hell. Dallas is an awful place to fly through, you know. I'm sorry for my friends from Dallas, but it's an awful place, and it was winter time, and you know I had booked it just right. You know, you fly in, you land, you get off the plane, and you got just enough time, like, to go to the bathroom, get a cup of coffee, stretch your legs, and then you get, like, go to the gate next to where you got off, and you get onto the next airplane. But apparently, there was a rumor that somebody saw a snowflake, which shuts down Dallas, apparently. Apparently, they're not able to do anything if there's a snowflake in Dallas. And so they shut down the airport. And, you know, like, it's like 3 or 4 hours later, and there's, like, no end in sight, and I'm there at the airport, and, you know, I'm pissed. It's awful. I'm sitting there. There's... you know, the airline sucks, the weather people suck, the airport sucks, the travel agents, everybody sucks, and all the people in the airport besides me suck, and, you know, it's awful, and I'm not accepting any of these things that are going on, because you know, I'm a big shot, I'm an important guy, I got people to see, places to go, things to do, which I'm sure was nothing, but, you know, in my mind, because it's in my head, you know, I had things to do, and I was important. And I'm sitting there, and I'm kind of sitting on the aisle of the gate, and, you know, I got my elbows on my knees, and I'm staring down at the ground, and I'm burning a hole in the floor. I'm pissed. I'm just pissed. What is wrong with these people? Why aren't we getting on the airplane and leaving? You know, maybe it's not such a good idea if the professionals think that you shouldn't be flying, that not to be flying, but, you know, that's not what I'm thinking. And I'm sitting there, and the longer I'm sitting there, the more angry I am, and finally, you know, I'm staring at the floor, and all of a sudden there are a pair of shoes between my shoes, and I look up like this, and there's a belt buckle right here. Yeah. And I'm like, getting ready to swing, because I don't like anybody in my personal space, and it's crowded, and I don't like crowds, and all of a sudden this person is standing there, and I am not in acceptance of anything in the world at that moment, and I look up, and it was Dr. Paul, and he looked down at me, and he said, he had this funny, like, nasal twang, for those of you who knew him, and he said, young man, it looks like you could use some ice cream, and I'm like... Okay, God, I guess I'm in acceptance now. You know, the man who wrote the chapter in the book that says acceptance is the key to all of my problems today is here to give me a lesson. So I guess I'm a student that's ready to learn. And you know, we went and sat down and had some ice cream and talked about acceptance for a while, and all of a sudden it was okay. The weather was okay, and the delay was okay. And you know, time and time again, when I needed God to bring somebody into my life to teach me a lesson, you know, that person has always been there. And you know, one of the great things about being around for a long time is I got to know some of those guys that had been around for a long time. And if you're new, you know, that's such a loss for you that you didn't get to know Dr. Paul and you didn't get to know Eddie C. and you didn't get to know some of those other old timers that were around, like Bill Marcus and Ted Harback and some of those guys that were here for a while that paved the way for us to be here today. You know, and that's the great thing about being able to be sober for a long time. And really owe a debt of gratitude to those people. But if you are new, you know, it's good that you're here. And, you know, I'll tell you that there will be no shortage of people squarely up your ass to tell you what to do. And that's what they do here. You know, they'll be telling you sponsor meetings, blah, 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 until you're sick of it. And I got to tell you, if you're new tonight, there's one thing that you should probably do, and that's pick up the book. And there's some really good information in there. But figure out whether or not you're an alcoholic. Maybe you just had bad luck. Maybe, you know, you got in the car and you just had that one cocktail at the party too many. And you know, you only drink on New Year's Eve or whatever it is. But, you know, for the rest of us, we're probably here because we need to be. And, you know, if you're new, just check it out for a while. And we have some really good information that will help you help you make up your mind before you actually, get a sponsor and work some steps and things like that. But anyway, I like I said, I don't like to talk too much about drinking and using because, frankly, I've heard every war story, drunk a log, that if I never hear another one the rest of my life, it will be too soon. You know, I don't care how much you drank. I don't care, you know, if you were the king of cocaine. I don't care. I just don't care. You know, I have encyclopedic knowledge in my head about how to get loaded, and I don't need any more information. I do not need any more information about how to get drunk and how to get stoned and how to sail, manufacture, or anything else because, you know, already been there, done that. So, you know, and if you're sitting in a lot of meetings and people are talking a lot about their drunk a lot, you know, stop them. You know, if you've been sober for a little bit, you know, you have the responsibility to do that. You know, going to meetings isn't about sharing your drunk a log. The only time you need to share your drunk a log is when you're on a 12-step call. You know, you should be going to meetings and share your experience, strength, and hope. And the newcomers in the meeting need to know how to stay sober. They don't need to know how to drink. They need to know how to stay sober. They need to know how to work a step. They need to know that you know how to do it. They need to know that somebody else has been down that road before them. And, you know, if that's not what's happening in the meetings you're going to, you know, you're responsible to help change that. And, you know, I'm one of those radicals that think that, you know, treatment centers and some other things have really diluted the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, you will hear a lot of lies in Alcoholics Anonymous in the meetings. And, you know, probably, I guarantee you, every one of you within the last 7 days has heard something like, don't drink, go to meetings, and it'll all be okay. And I'm telling you, that's a fucking lie. And if you read the book, it'll tell you it's a lie. That's not what they talk about in the book. That's crap out of some treatment center from some psychologist who's making a trainload of money out of some suffering alcoholic. And, you know, if I could not drink, I would not be here on a Friday night. You know, I mean, when I got sober in 1986, you know, Nancy Reagan was the first lady, and you know, and her big thing was just say no, and it's like, I never said no one time in my life. That's like such a foreign concept to me. I just don't understand. It was like, just say no? What? I don't get it. And, you don't get sober by going to meetings. I mean, you just don't. You know, some good information there, but you don't get sober by going to meetings. You get sober by working the steps. You get sober by getting a sponsor, and you get sober by doing the steps, not by thinking about them, talking about them, worrying about them, procrastinating about them. You get sober by actually doing the steps. And I'm sorry, I already said that, like, what, four times? I'm going to do it for about six more times in the next 15 minutes. So, you know, what you'll hear is that, you know, the steps up here on the wall, they're just a suggestion, and that's what you'll hear. And, you know, that's true, they're just a suggestion, but they are the only suggestion we have. They are the only thing that we have to suggest to you is to work the steps. That's how you will recover from alcoholism. And that's it. But I'm only going to talk about two times that I drank. And I'm going to talk about the first time I drank when I crossed that invisible line that they talk about. And I'm going to talk about the last time that I drank. The first time I drank, I was about 13 years old, and I'm the youngest of six kids. My brother, who's 4 years older than me, was home, and I was home. Everybody else was gone. And my parents were going to go on this short little business/vacation trip and leave us home alone. And nobody ever accused them of having good judgment. They had six of us, you know. But you know, and I remember, you know, they left, and I think the party started about 5 seconds after they got to the stoplight at the end of the street, you know. And we had this little three-bedroom house, and there must have been 300 people in there. And, I mean, it was packed. And my brother was a senior in high school, and he wrestled. He weighed 132 pounds, but he could bench press 350. And he was a stud. He still is a stud today. And he met everybody on the way in and said, "If you break anything, I will break you." And amazingly, there were that many drunk high school kids, and nothing got broken. And my mother actually didn't find out about this until shortly before she died, actually. We were talking about it, like, my brother and I were talking about it, and it was like, oh, yeah, remember that week that they left, and oh, my God. And it's like, well, yeah, that's when I kind of crossed that invisible line. And my mom's like, well, what are you guys talking about? And, you know, I mean, they were gone for a week, and I was drunk for a week. I was drunk the entire week. I was not able to make it to school, you know, and that's just the way it was. But I remember that Friday night. You know, everybody that came to the party, they had to bring two of whatever they were bringing. And, you know, one was for the host of the party and one was for them. And so I snagged a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill and a couple of Schlitz malt liquors. And, yeah, ooh was later. Yeah, that's right. And my brother's best friend, Matt Stone, who I know I'm going to meet in a meeting one of these days, but he was selling joints for 50 cents a piece. And so I got out my crisp $1 bill, and I was ready to go. My best friend Wayne Patterson and I, who I always look around to see, was Wayne here tonight, you know, but because he was definitely one of us. But he and I were in the basement, and we had a couple joints, and we had a bottle of wine, we had a couple of malt liquors, and we proceeded to get loaded. And I remember getting loaded, and I remember being totally drunk, totally stoned, totally out of control, and totally terrified. Just terrified. It was the first time I'd really been outside of my head. And I was terrified, and I remember having the conscious thought, I can't wait to do this again. and you know what? For the next 14 years, I did as often as I could. And I was 13 years old when I got loaded for the first time. And I got to tell you, you know, I really needed to drink when I was 10. I really needed one when I was 9. I probably needed one coming out of the womb. I needed, you know, a little mixed in with the formula or something, you know, because that's just the way I am. You know, I am an alcoholic, and alcohol goes to the core of my very innermost being. And, you know, I can tell you that for the next 14 years, my pattern was real simple. If I was here and the drink was here, anything that came between me and the drink, I was going to make disappear, you know, and that's what I did. You know, and I made educational opportunities disappear. I made career opportunities disappear. I made a wife disappear. I made a child disappear. I made three brothers who loved me disappear. I made two sisters that loved me. I made them disappear. I made two parents who really did love me. I was their baby. I was the surprise child. You know, they had 5 and 7 years, and then 4 years later, they had me. I was that surprise child. And my parents really did love me. And I made them disappear. I made them go away. I made everything disappear. I made jobs disappear. You name it, anything in my life that could have been positive or good, I made disappear if it came between me and the drink. And that's just how it was. And that's how my life was for the next 14 years. And you know, the biggest thing that I made disappear is I made a big piece of my soul disappear. You know, that all that drinking and using did not come without a price. And it took me a long time being sober to find out exactly what that price was. And, you know, and it was a heavy one. But, you know, I don't like to share a lot of war stories about what happened, so I won't. And, You know, I'll fast forward to Thanksgiving in 1985. And Thanksgiving in 1985, I was living in Laguna Beach. I was sharing a three-bedroom house with a roommate. And she was the only woman I ever knew. She was the only person I ever knew that smoked more pot than I did. You know, I mean, she was a freak of nature. But, you know, we were home, and it was Thanksgiving. And, you know, we were going to cook dinner for all of our friends that had no place to go. And really what that meant is we had no place to go, so we were going to cook dinner. That's how that translated. And it was about 10 o'clock in the morning, and I was smoking a joint, and I was drinking some bourbon, and I was cooking. And the phone rang, and it was my buddy Rod. And Rod said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "The party's already started." And he said, "I'll be there in an hour." And I'm pretty sure that Rod got there that day, and I'm pretty sure that we probably had dinner that day, but I just don't have any real recollection of it. And, and then you can fast forward a month till Christmas, and I'm sure that there was a Christmas and a Christmas Eve of 1985. I have no recollection of it at all. I'm sure that there was a New Year's Eve and a New Year's Day. Have no memory. Don't know. Can't tell you. Don't know anything about it. And, the only thing I remember from January is the space shuttle blew up that year. And I remember that. And I remember watching on TV and crying. The next thing I really remember is January the 30th, 1986. I was working that day. And I was working from 3 o'clock in the afternoon until 9 o'clock at night. I was selling new Porsches in Orange County and all the things that went with that. And I was coming home that night at 9 o'clock, and my plan was I was going to go straight to bed because I had to get up in the morning, and I had to go down and talk to the district attorney about, you know, why I'd never paid child support for, you know, that child that I had abandoned. And, you know, so I was going to get home. I was going to go to bed, I was going to get a good night's sleep, and I was going to go and I was going to take care of business. I was going to man up, and I was going to go do the right thing for a change. And you know what happened is I got home, and my buddy Rod was there, and my roommate was there, and they were drinking and they were using. And I said, "No, I don't want to." And I ended up drinking against my will. And that sounds strange, but it's actually true. For some reason, I didn't want to drink that night, and I drank anyway. Which was not a usual occurrence for me. And at the end of my using and drinking, I was suffering from a physical phenomenon that some alcoholics have. I abused my body so much that I suffered from a condition called reverse tolerance. And one night I might drink a fifth of Wild Turkey and be pretty sober. And the next night I might drink two beers and be completely shit-faced. And there was no pattern to that. And it was Mr. Toad's wild ride, let me tell you. I got home that night, and we started using and we started drinking, and I drank a lot of bourbon that night. And I drank some more, and there were some other things that we did. And I was sitting there at 4 o'clock in the morning in the absolute worst place that an alcoholic can ever be. Inside my own head, completely sober and cognizant of my life and what was going on. And I couldn't get loaded. I could not get drunk. And it was an awful, awful, awful place to be. And it was 4 o'clock in the morning, and there's a silence that it's at 4 o'clock in the morning that's, you know, it's deafening. It's loud. It's so quiet. And I'm sitting there with my best friend, Rod. And he was my best friend because he was my only friend. He was the only person that I didn't make disappear from my life because he never got between me and a drink. And we each had pretty good drug connections, so that was a lot of the attraction there, too. But we're sitting there, and for the first time in my life, at 27 years old, I got honest with another human being, and I was sitting on the couch, and I looked at my best and only friend, Rod, and I said, "Rod, I'm really miserable. I'm really miserable. My life isn't working. I'm really unhappy, and I don't know what to do." Now, this isn't the kind of, you know, conversation you usually have with somebody where you're getting loaded. And you know, usually the closest to that is, I love you, man, you know, but you know, that's as close to emotion as you get. You know, we have those kind of conversations sober, but not, you know, in here, but not when we're out there. And Rod had to think about it for a minute. And it was really quiet, and I could hear the gears turning in Rod's head. And he was trying to decide what he was going to say. And he thought about it for a minute, and he's looking straight ahead, and he finally goes, well, Jim, I don't have any answers for you, but I know some people that do. And I had arrived at step one. That was my 12-step call. And I didn't know it at the time. I didn't find out until later. Rod was 30 years old, and he'd been trying to get sober for 11 years. And the most he'd had was 5 months. And he went out after 5 months on Thanksgiving Day at my house. And I pressed Rod for some information, and he was having no part of it. He was just dodging every question I had for him. And he left shortly after that. And I kind of figured out later that, much later, actually, that, you know, I was technically what was called a buzzkill. Because apparently that head full of AA and that body full of dope was just not good for him, not good combination for him. But I went, and then you go through the calculation. Let's see, it's 4:30. If I go to sleep now, and you know, and I can sleep for an hour and 30 minutes, and then I got up and I went to court and I did some shuck and jive to this poor woman and put her together, and she never knew what was happening. And one more time I slid by. One more time I slid away. And then I went and did, you know, something that I can't explain to this day. Instead of going back home to my house, my three-bedroom house in Laguna Beach overlooking the ocean, I went to, I checked into a motel on South Harbor Boulevard in Anaheim. And that was before it was the Anaheim resort area, let me tell you. All the motels over there were hooker dope fiend motels. I mean, I guess I wanted to be around my people. And I went and checked into that motel, and I didn't drink and I didn't use, and I got up the next day, the next day was kind of a fog, and I drove around, and I don't really remember anything that happened, and I decided I need to seek out some answers. So I drove up to Rod's apartment in Rosemead, and I showed up to his house at about 7:30, and I knocked on his door, the door of his apartment, unannounced, and he invited me in, and we sat down on the couch, and I told him, I said, Rod, you know, my life's not working, I'm miserable, and I don't know what to do. And he stood up and he said, Jim, I don't have any answers for you, but I know some people that do. Come with me. And we walked out of his apartment, we walked down the steps, we walked around the pool, and we walked into the clubhouse of the apartment complex. And there were a bunch of people in there, and there was an 8 o'clock meeting getting ready to start. I haven't had a drug or a drink since. Like I said, that's been 8,120 days ago. And that's not because of my power. By my own human power, I could not get sober. I could not stop drinking. I could not stop using drugs. You know, it was all about, I got into the steps, and I got into doing the deal. And that's what I did. And I got busy, and I got sober, and I got married, and I started a business, and I made a train load of money and bought the big house on the hill and did a lot of things. And I can remember a morning, it was a Saturday morning, I was 14 years sober. And I was standing out in front of my house and I was smoking a Cuban cigar, and I was standing in the driveway of this house, and it was a big house on a big acre lot with a big swimming pool and a big horse corral, and there are a few people in this room that were at that house.
It rocked.
It really did. It was a bitchin' house. Problem with all these people in here that know me, I gotta keep on my toes because I gotta tell the truth because they know me. But I'm standing there in my driveway, and I got this driveway where it comes up and it kind of goes to a Y, and you can park like five cars and not block anybody in. And I'm standing there smoking this Cuban cigar. And I'm looking at my BMW convertible, and I got my new Corvette convertible, and I got my Cadillac, and I got my four-wheel drive, and I got my Harley sitting in the garage, I'm looking down the street, and the street in Fullerton is up in Sunny Hills in Fullerton, and they call this street Pill Hill because that's where all the doctors live. It was a beautiful street with the big Chinese elm trees, and you know, I'm standing there smoking this cigar, and you know, and I got a wife in the house who loves me, that thinks I'm a great guy. You know, I got a girlfriend across town that loves me and thinks I'm a great guy. Oh yeah, that too, huh? And I'm smoking this cigar, and I'm thinking, God, I don't think I could be any more miserable than I am today. It's not about the it's that you get. And, you know, shortly after that, I had to start getting honest in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had to go back and start over again. I had to go back, and I had to work some steps, and I had to get another sponsor, and I had to do a lot of stuff, because I was either going to drink or I was going to kill myself, one of the two. I knew I couldn't be dishonest like that and stay sober. And, you know, Ralph talks about when we get sober that it's kind of like a whack-a-mole game. You know, like they have a Chuck E. Cheese, you know, and you got this one problem, alcohol, and you pound that down. And gambling pops up. It's son of a bitch. And then it's sex. And then it's food. And then it's, you know, work. And then it's, you know, it's always something. You know, because we want to obsess on something. We want to get outside of our own heads with something. And, you know, that's what it was all about. But you know, I got busy and I got sober and I changed my life. And the message is that if you're sitting in this room tonight and you've been sober for a while and you haven't done the work, you can do the work. It's not too late. You don't have to go out and drink to start your program over again. And you can get back into the steps. And you can get back and do the things that you need to do. And you know, it will be worth the journey. It will be worth the journey. You know, there's no coincidence that I've known six people since I've been sober that stone cold sober with some time, they walked out in their backyard and put a gun in their mouth and blew their brains out. Because that's just how miserable it is. Because if I can't drink and I don't have God in my life, I'm screwed. I am screwed. I've got no place to go. I got no place to hide. I got no place to run. And you know, that's what happened to me. I want to share a little bit about the last year and a half has been busy for me. And you know, I ended a relationship that I'd been in for about 4 years that I was ready to stay in for the rest of my life, and against my will it was ended, I guess. And means I got kicked to the curb is really what that means. And you know, that was really tough, and I got into another relationship, and you know, and they say, you know, that pain is the touchstone to growth, and if that's true, I grew like a son of a bitch, but I stayed sober, and that was the important thing, and I stayed busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got busy, and I always sponsored five or six guys, and there were seven or eight, and then there was nine or ten, and then there was a dozen, and now there's 16, and wow. You know, and 16 guys is a lot of 16 people is a lot to sponsor, and you know, if you just had that thought in your head, you know, well, he's sponsoring too many people. Well, then get off your fucking ass and do some work. I need some help, and you know. You know, and anyway, last August, you know, I went to the doctor, and it was just that regular checkup to, you know, renew a couple of prescriptions, and he looked at me, and he said, Jim, how long have your lymph nodes been swollen? And I said, well, doc, I could tell you that if I knew where my lymph nodes were. And he said, yeah, they look a little swollen, and to make a long story short, you know, I did some blood work, and he called me in a couple of days, and he said, Jim, I've already cleared it with you. The insurance company, and you need to go make an appointment at Hoag Hospital, and here's the number, and you know, you need to have a biopsy done on your lymph nodes, and I've already sent them the order to do that. And you know, I hung up the phone, and I knew that I was sick, and I knew that it was serious, and I knew that I wasn't going to die, and I knew that I was going to be sick for 6 months. Don't ask me how I knew all this stuff, but I knew it, and I talked about it to some people, and you know, sure enough, I went and did the test, and I had lymphoma and leukemia, and I just finished chemo about 6 weeks ago, and, you know, it's all good now, but, you know, somebody recently said, you know, that, I'm so sorry that, you know, you were sick and so on and so forth. And it was like, I can tell you that being sick was one of the single most great experiences of my life. You know, when I got sick, you know, it showed me that, showed me what life was all about. You know, I didn't have to do that, God, get me out of this one prayer. Mm-hmm. It was like, I was sitting there and I said, God, I will do whatever. I'm whatever you want, I'm here to do it. If whatever's going to happen, I'm okay with. And the only thing I asked that, I was able to walk through it with a little bit of grace and dignity, and that's what happened. And you know, and I got to tell you that I got sick, and the AA Army showed up, and it was pretty overwhelming for me because I'm a pretty low key kind of guy. And you know, I had four people tell me immediately, "Well, what we're going to do," and these were four people independent of each other, said, "Well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to pack up all the stuff in your apartment, and we're going to put it in storage, and you're going to move into my extra bedroom, and I'm going to take care of you." And, you know, that was pretty amazing. And I had a lot of people praying for me, and I had a lot of people calling me every day. And you know, I got to tell you that you know, I've done a lot of drugs, so I have a lot of comparative analysis. And I got to tell you that the chemo drugs, they really suck. They're not fun at all. Yeah, it was not a good buzz. Let me tell you that. But, you know, I was able to get through that. I was able to walk through that. And I was able to go to the other side. And it was all because, you know, I did the footwork. And I did exactly what the doctor told me to do. And that's what I learned to do in AA. You know, I took those steps and walked through it. But at any rate, life is good today. Life is really good today. And I want to thank you again for asking me to share it with you. Thank you.